It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's Attorney General announced an agreement between 51 attorneys general with telephone companies to crack down on robocalls. We'll find out what's in that agreement and whether it'll make a difference. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
Received a flurry of questions through the Wisconsin Project from the fourth grade class at Mineral Point Elementary School. Most of the questions were about the state of Wisconsin. Questions like, how did Wisconsin get all of its cows? And who invented the state dog? We sent WPR's Mary Kate McCoy to investigate.
When I saw these questions come in, I got really excited. It's because I'm from Mineral Point, and one question in particular stood out to me, from Josie Dunn. Because, full disclosure, I've known Josie for a long time.
Josie, we know each other, don't we?
Yeah.
How do we know each other?
You were my old babysitter.
Mm-hmm. We had some fun, didn't
mm-hmm.
we? You wrote a question to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and what was your question?
How did Wisconsin get its name?
And why do you want to know the answer to that?
Because Wisconsin's a really unique name for a state, and I just really wanted to know why it was mainly called Wisconsin.
And what do you think the answer is?
Maybe the person who, like, lived in the state. The state didn't really have a name yet. Maybe made Wisconsin a state and named it after him.
And are you excited to find out the answer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that's a somewhat tricky question to answer. But what we do know is that it came from the Algonquian language family, spoken by Wisconsin tribes like the Menominee, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Mohican. And it certainly was not pronounced Wisconsin.
I was always told it was Wiscusa. And some people have said Wisconsin. There's a Wiscoset, a Wiscosec.
Napoose is an elder in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, a member of the Menominee tribe.
To translate that would be basically the first part comes from the word Wiscu, which means something good. And that ending is more, what you would say, locative. Then you would say a good place to, like, camp or to make a clearing or to basically live.
Rand Valentine is a University of Wisconsin-Madison Linguistics and American Studies professor. He offers another interpretation.
The word Wisconsin originates from an Algonquian language word, meskusing. And meskusing is probably Miami, Illinois language, but possibly Ojibwe. It's a little bit uncertain. And the word translates as where it lies red. And the best guess is that's making reference to the red cliffs around the Dells.
But once the French got a hold of the word, Napoose says its pronunciation started to change.
The big confusion, though, was when the French came in. A lot of those names were mistranslated because basically they couldn't pronounce them.
Many scholars trace a European adoption of the name Wisconsin to the missionary and explorer Father Jacques Marquette. Valentine says the change came after he traveled across Wisconsin from Green Bay to the Mississippi River with fur trader Louis Joliet and two Miami Indians as guides.
He recorded this word as their word for the Wisconsin River. They themselves were refugees here in Wisconsin. There was lots of turmoil in the 17th century.
So then where did the W come from? Valentine says that came from a simple misreading of the text.
There was a famous map maker, and he showed the name to LaSalle, who mistook the first two letters, which were just this very flamboyant M, as O-I, which he interpreted as we.
Over time, as more English speakers settled into the area, the French spelling was changed to the more English W. Napoose and Valentine agree that knowing where the name comes from is powerful.
If you're a language speaker, you should know what that means by breaking it down. And that's the importance of language, because if you don't have that quality, then you're just reciting.
When we recognize that this state's very name comes from one of the languages of the country's first people, it will perhaps give us a greater appreciation for their place, not just in the past, but in the present.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us this story. And Josie's question came to us through the Wisconsin Project. We'll hear even more questions from the Mineral Point fourth graders on the Larry Mueller Show on May 15th. Submit your own questions and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. A quick correction. Yesterday when we were listing state lawmakers who might run for Congress after the departure next month of Sean Duffy, we referred to State Assembly Representative Nick Milroy of South Range as a Republican. He is, in fact, a Democrat. Now, the bid call of the auctioneer is a unique sound, and there's a lot more to the job than we might realize. Being a fast talker is not the only qualification. In fact, it takes special training and years of practice and experience. Earlier, we talked to Jenny Markham-Gale. She's an auctioneer and bid assistant for Bravo Benefit Auctions and Consulting Group. She was named earlier this year as the 2019 champion at the Wisconsin Champion Auctioneer Contest. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You got into auctions at a really young age. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I did. I actually grew up in an auctioneer family. Both my dad and brother were both auctioneers. So you bet I was probably 10 years old and had to do a lot of the jobs as a child to help out the family auction business.
Whether you were a cashier, right?
That's right. Cashier, running sheets, whatever it took.
And how did you decide, hey, I want to actually be up there. I want to be the auctioneer.
You know, I have to tell you, when I graduated from high school and basically said, hey, see ya, you know, and I went and did my thing and went on to college, got my bachelor's degree, and then, you know, worked in other industries. And I always had that love for the auction industry. And I thought, gosh, what? I would really like to get back into it. So I researched and I found that there was a benefit auction specialist certification offered through the National Auctioneers Association, and it was for fundraisers. And I thought, you know what? This is my thing. I think that's what I want to do. So that's what brought me back into it, even though I've helped. I've always helped, even though I had other jobs, but yes.
So you love auctioneering. What is it about being up in an auction that's exciting for you?
Yes. What is so exciting is that competitive bidding environment. And it's exciting, and the fear of loss that the bidders have, and it's so fun to get them engaged.
And benefit auctioneering, talk about that specialty. Who do you end up doing benefits for?
Yeah, who I work with is a lot of nonprofit organizations, and I work a lot with schools. We work a lot with foundations, humane societies, Make-A-Wish Foundation. Just there's a lot of different organizations that we work with.
Is there a difference between an auction for a charity versus, you know, a farm auction or the other kinds of auctions that you've seen in the past?
Absolutely, there is. With the fundraising auction, it's a little bit different. We have to structure our chant a little different. We have to go a little bit slower because of the folks that are sitting in those seats. They don't attend auctions every day. So we kind of have to slow down that chant a little bit, be a little bit more engaging, have some fun with it.
So usually at the more normal auctions, there's going to be regulars in the crowd. They know how this works.
Absolutely. They're bidding maybe with a wink, right?
Or really?
A head nod. Yeah. So it's a little different.
No way. I'm kind of a twitchy fella when I'm just sitting around. I'd be worried I'd start accidentally bidding up and all of a sudden I owe a lot of money on a tractor or something.
That's right. And it happens. You know, I have to tell you, I'm a pretty good ringman also, so I can watch for those bids. Kind of mastered the craft of reading that audience and
ringman.
Crowd. Yes, a ringman. And I seriously, but at the end of the auction, I swear I can tell people how many times they touch their hat or scratch their ear, right? Because I'm always on the lookout.
Wow.
For
so for these fundraising ones, though, I assume there's a more very distinct way people bid so they don't accidentally bid things up.
That's right.
The
yeah.
non-professionals. So,
yeah.
Like, what are some of the main ways they do that?
Yeah. So the main ways that they bid, they all have paddles or bidder cards, and we have them raise them in the air. So, yeah.
We're talking to Jenny Markham-Gale. She is the 2019 champion of the Wisconsin Champion Auctioneer Contest. She's been involved with auctions from a very early age. All right, Jenny, I've been holding off. People want to hear more. I think they probably ask you all the time about the chant, you called it, the talking, the patter people might think of it as.
That's right. It's called the auctioneer's chant. And basically, it's that fast talking situation that gets people excited to bid. And there's a lot of characteristics to an auctioneer in that chant. But what I did was I kind of broke it down into three components. And if you want me to get into that,
yes,
I can kind of start getting into that. So I would say, basically when we're an auctioneer, we'll say, I have $5, will you give 10? Okay, mm-hmm. So that's kind of the basis. And what we do is we practice those numbers. There's a number scale. So every time before I compete or before I go to an auction, I work on my numbers. I'll do it in quarters. I'll do it in halves, fives, tens, like this. We'll get 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, and then I'll go back down the scale. 50, 45, 40, 35, 30, 2.5, 5, 7 and a half, 10, 12 and a half, 15, 17 and a half, 22 and a half, 25, 22 and a half, 20, 17 and a half, 15, 12 and a half, 10. All right. So
you're soliciting the opening bid with that, right?
That's kind of more a warm up for
okay.
me.
Oh, that's
kind
your warm up.
Practice.
I get it. Okay.
Yeah. So if you would you like right. to maybe practice, we'll do tens. We'll okay. go 10, 10, 20, 20, all the way up to 100 and then backwards.
Okay.
So this is something that I do to warm up for an auction. Okay.
All
so
right.
join me 10, 10, 10, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20, 20,
practice on it.
The second component of an auctioneer chant is rhythm. An auctioneer has to have rhythm and some voice inflection. And how we attain that as auctioneers is we practice tongue twisters. Here's one I like to do. I go, Betty Botter bought some butter, but she said this butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, I'll make my batter bitter, but I bought a bit of butter, butter. All right, you get it. Now, there's another one that I'll do, and it's called Tommy Atatimus. Sounds like this. Tommy Atatimus took two T's, tied them at the top of two tall trees. So do you want to join me?
Okay,
we'll do it
ready?
Twice.
Okay.
Ready?
Tommy Atatimus took two T's, tied them to the top of two tall trees.
Okay. Tommy Atatimus took two T's, tied them to the top of two tall trees. There you go.
Okay. Okay. I could work on that.
And the third component of an auctioneer chant, as I break it down simple, is the words that we put in between the numbers. Mm-hmm. They're called filler words. All right. My five filler words that I use a lot are you able to buy, would you give, dollar, now, and bid. Okay, so if you combine the rhythm with the number and the filler words, it'll sound like this. We'll get five on it, would get $10 there, would get 10, 20 bid, 30 there, would get 40 able to buy it, $40, would get 50, sir, 50, 50 now, would get 50 able to buy it, $60, 70, 70 there, would get $70 now, would get 70, sold it your way, $60.
Now, not every auctioneer is going to use those same filler words, right? That's kind of where you get to put some of your own personality into it.
That's true. Every auctioneer, those filler words, they're different for every auctioneer. Because
really?
It just depends what rolls off of your tongue. Like my dad uses different filler words than I do. I don't even know what my father's filler words are, believe it or not. Because you have to focus on what works for you mm-hmm. as an auctioneer. So,
and whatever keeps you rolling there.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah,
so did you have to experiment with different filler words and you realize that one just gums up the works?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I have to tell you, that auctioneer's chant, especially mine too, it changes, you know, with each event and you find things that work better for you as you go along. So
what speed would you go at for a kind of a greenhorn charity auction? If people like me are out there who are just trying to figure out what the heck's going on, what would be the pace there?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're dealing with, you know, some big numbers there, too. It might be 1,000. Who will give 1,000 there? Would get 1,000 able to buy it? $1,000. Are you in at 1,000, Rob? Would you
I'm
like
not.
To be 2,000 now? I think you should. 1,000. Money, Rob.
Is there a persuasive element? Kind of you're trying, because ideally the person, the group you're raising money for wants to see bigger bids. So you're trying to coax a little bigger
yes,
bid out of people.
Absolutely. And you know, I have to tell you, every time we do a live fundraising auction, we bring in a team. And actually, it's my dad, my brother, and myself. And
okay.
when I'm the auctioneer and my dad, my brother are out there, they're an extension of that auctioneer. And they're bringing excitement and energy and fun. You know, and we have our own little language that we kind of talk to each other through the chant and through hand signals. So it really makes it a lot of fun when we can all work together as a team.
And are the other members of the team watching for, are they helping you watch for the bids as they come in? Or is
Absolutely.
That all you?
Absolutely. They're helping me watch for the bids and then they're putting their fist up in the air and saying yes and trying to coax just
cheering.
One more bid out of them. Yeah.
Okay. So. Do you ever get, have you, maybe in your earlier days especially, did you ever get tongue-tied up on the auction stage, the block, whatever it would be?
You know, I mean, it happens sometimes, but usually, you know,
because I do here.
Yeah,
this is my, they
absolutely.
Pay me to do this and
I'd
be lying,
right,
sometimes.
If I said no. Yeah, you know what? And actually, you just kind of go with the flow. You kind of pick up where you left off. And that's when you count on your ringmen, too. They'll kind of help you through it.
Now, what was going through your head the first time? Because you've been watching auctions. You've been watching your family do it. You've been watching other people auction. What was it like the first time you were making the bid calls up there?
The first time I was making the bid calls, I would say, you know, maybe a little nervous, but exciting at the same time to know that, hey, you know, here I am, something I always wanted to do, and to be in that position of helping deserving organizations, you know, raise money. It's pretty exciting.
And you mentioned you get a certification, there's training. Mm-hmm. What kind of things, apart from the tongue twisters, what kind of things do you do to get trained and certified to do this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have to tell you, one to actually, they have auctioneer school. There's a lot of great schools throughout the country. So I did go to an auctioneer school, and I did get special certification for benefit auctioneer, where I learned specifically about the fundraising trade. Mm-hmm. You know, we share experiences, we share knowledge about, hey, what sells, what's trendy, what works for you. So.
And do you have, like, I don't know, game show moments, Price is Right moments, where somebody realizes they won this thing they want and they just freak out?
Absolutely. Yes, it can get pretty exciting with some of these. You know, and one of the most exciting projects that I worked on happened here in Madison. It was the Bucky Badger finale event, where we sold the Bucky Badgers by live auction at the Kohl
Center. So these were statues they had up for people who weren't in Madison at the time. These are big statues, very differently decorated one to the other. And so you were auctioning those?
Yeah. Actually, I was part of the auction team for that, and there was about 950 guests in the Kohl Center, right? And the energy and the excitement,
wow,
wearing Badger red and white, and yeah, it was just, I mean, the momentum and the excitement in that room was amazing. And again, raising money for deserving organizations.
Have you ever been a bidder at an auction, or that should be too weird for you? Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
I try to go to all different kinds of auctions. And, you know, during the week, I'll hit up some auctions, and I like to just kind of see what's out there.
Jenny, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Jenny Markham-Gale is an auctioneer and bid assistant for Bravo Benefit Auctions and Consulting Group. She's a graduate of the Worldwide College of Auctioneering and recently named 2019 champion at the Wisconsin Champion Auctioneer Contest. Coming up, white working class voters are often seen as President Trump's base, but our guest says things are more complicated than that here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Donald Trump was the first Republican presidential candidate to win the state of Wisconsin in more than 30 years when he defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016. A lot of that came from a base of white blue-collar voters. That group gets talked about as a key for the Trump campaign going into the next election. But our next guest took a look at a couple years' worth of data and found that things aren't quite so simple in Wisconsin. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, and sorry for calling in late.
No problem, Craig. So tell us, how much of Wisconsin's voting population falls under this category of blue-collar white voters before we start to break it down by category?
Yeah, so first of all, we should say what we mean by blue-collar.
Sure.
It's sort of shorthand in polling speak for someone without a four-year college degree. It's not the only way to define blue-collar, but it's the way where we have the most polling data. And it makes up more than half of the electorate in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, in fact, of all the pivotal states in 2020, has the highest proportion of blue-collar white voters. It's, you know, between 55% and 60%. So it's so big a group that it turns out it's pretty hard to generalize about them.
Right. And you used polling data from a couple few years in Wisconsin to break it down. What are some of the big divides within this group that we look at sometimes as one thing?
Yeah, we put together 3 years of polling data from the Marquette Law School just so we could drill down into that large category and look at, you know, some of the dividing lines within that group. And some of these dividing lines are quite familiar to you know, the people listening in right now. I mean, we start out with education, which we're dividing the world into white blue collar and white college to begin with. But then within that non-college white group, there's a gender gap. There's a huge religion gap between evangelicals and people of varying religions and people who declare no religion and don't go to church. There's regional differences and there's age differences. So just to take the most extreme set of differences within this population of blue-collar white voters, if evangelical men, born-again Protestant men who are white, non-college, give Trump an 80% approval rating. But if you go to the other end of that spectrum, non-religious women who are white and blue collar give Trump something like a 20% approval rating. So President Trump's standing within this big group that we think of as demographic shorthand for his base varies spectacularly along some of these dividing lines. And so, you know, the good news, if you're a Democrat, is that this is not a monolithic group, and there are group segments within this population that Democrats are quite competitive with. But overall, for Republicans, you know, he does still have a positive approval rating. It's not massively positive, but it's held pretty steady.
Yeah, talk about what President Trump would have to do to keep that appeal of not just that core group of evangelical men in the working class, but the rest of them, too.
Yeah, so he's, I mean, one thing that's happened in Wisconsin is that blue-collar men have been steadily becoming more Republican in their party identification, and that actually predates Trump, but it continues under President Trump. So that's a challenge for Democrats, certainly. They are quite competitive among blue-collar women, but among blue-collar men, that group of voters is kind of slipping away from the Democratic Party to some degree. The challenge for President Trump is that, you know, his overall approval rating among this large population of non-college whites is like 51-52% positive, 45% negative. So people are pretty divided. He actually has to do much better than his approval rating in the vote to get reelected in Wisconsin. I mean, he won this group by something like 25 or 27 points against Hillary Clinton, which was a pretty spectacular performance in historical terms. But his approval rating is lower than that 62 or 63% that he got of the vote. So he has to get a bunch of people who have qualms about him and who are conflicted about him to vote for him. And some of that is going to depend on how appealing the Democratic nominee is to these voters.
Just in 15, 20 seconds, Craig, the key issues for President Trump and immigration and a border wall. What does this group think of that?
Pretty divided on trade, on the tariff policy. A lot of people there have qualms about the tariff policy. And the border wall, very divided too. So again, it's not a monolithic picture of support for President Trump on these signature issues. There's a lot of division, and that's a big X factor going into 2020.
We'll leave it there for now. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He talked with us about the dynamics of Wisconsin's white, blue-collar voters and their support, mixed support for President Trump. You can read more at the Journal-Sentinel website. Coming up after the news, we'll look at a new agreement that state attorneys general say will help reduce the number of robocalls Americans have to deal with. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a major drug company has been ordered to pay more than $500 million for its role in Oklahoma's opioid epidemic. We'll look at that ruling and what it means for other opioid lawsuits around the country. First 51 attorneys general announced an agreement with telecom companies last night aimed at fighting illegal robocalls. Every state and Washington, D.C. participated in the agreement. In a state, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call said that the steps phone companies agreed to take will help dramatically reduce the number of robocalls people get here in Wisconsin. Sarah Krause covers the telecommunications industry for The Wall Street Journal. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Sarah, tell us what this agreement does. What are these big phone companies agreeing to do when it comes to robocalls?
So large telecom companies, and this is on a voluntary basis, have agreed to provide free call blocking technology to their customers to better investigate and trace illegal calls back to their origins and to confirm the identity of their commercial customers. And the whole concept here is to try to keep bad traffic off of their networks in the first place. It's sort of an acknowledgement that sort of blocking at the receiving end isn't quite enough to really stem the tide of these calls.
It's tricky, though. You've reported on this in the past. A lot of the calls that we get as consumers aren't coming from the big names, the AT&T or Verizon or whatever. They're coming from these other companies, and it's kind of hard to stop the calls from originating.
Correct. We've written about how a relatively small group of smaller carriers are bringing traffic either from international call centers onto the U.S. network or sort of turning a blind eye or carrying along suspect traffic and not necessarily participating in industry efforts to trace back calls to their origins. And I will say there have been efforts to really do that more carefully and start to see all the links in the chain of a phone call, because often a call touches many different carriers along the way. And part of this new agreement is agreeing to participate and work with state law enforcement officials investigating the origins of calls.
This is aimed at stopping illegal robocalls. What makes a robocall illegal? What makes one legal?
So this is what's tricky about the whole problem, is there are legal and there are illegal robocalls. Legal calls are like school notifications, or, you know, snow day type things, or pharmaceutical prescription pickups. Illegal robocalls are, you know, can use a pre-recorded message and call you without your consent. They can be made too late at night. They can be for telemarketing purposes when you're not an existing customer. There's all sorts of rules that put a call in the category of illegal, including, you know, the kind that we're all familiar with, scams and fraudulent calls that are trying to take your money or steal personal information.
This agreement among attorneys general and the big telecommunications companies, this doesn't add anything to that list of illegal, right? This is more about how do we enforce the laws we already have.
Yeah, this is really trying to turn the screws on the laws and rules that are already in place. The FCC has given carriers more latitude than they've had in the past to block suspect calls and has been more explicit about that. The carriers are also the biggest ones this year are starting to implement a protocol called Shaken and Stir, which will verify that the person calling has the right to use the number they're calling from. That's aimed at cracking down on spoofing, where they trick you and try to make you think that they're calling from a place close to you to get you to answer the phone. But yes, this new agreement is really about, you know, trying to better trace illegal calls back to their origins and help state officials, you know, sort of do investigations and come down on companies that aren't only, they're not just the scammers making the calls, there's companies that are complicit in this sort of call chain.
Yeah, and you mentioned the origins of these calls. Are they coming from inside the country even? Are we getting international calls calling into these things to where it would be really hard to enforce that?
It's both, and it's really hard to know. So there is definitely an international element to this, but there's also a domestic element where it's, you know, folks using, especially with very cheap internet-based calling services, it's very easy to start a small company and begin sort of using online resources to robo-dial. And so it's trying to get to the root of the problem better than what has been done in the past, where it's sort of whack-a-mole on the receiving end of the call.
Talking to Sarah Krause from the Wall Street Journal about a new agreement among attorneys general around the country and some of the big phone companies trying to crack down on robocalls. Sarah, I know some people might feel like we're getting more robocalls these days. What does the data tell us? Are they going up?
The data tells us it is indeed on the rise, and it is unclear how effective this agreement will be. It is a voluntary agreement. It doesn't have a deadline. It hasn't yet been signed by smaller companies. So there's room for skepticism, but this is also, I think the fact that all of the state's attorneys general were on board and all the biggest carriers, AT&T's, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, CenturyLink, the fact that you have these really big household names is an acknowledgement that this is a problem that consumers are fed up with and that they need to all sort of row in the same direction.
So there's a multi-step chain, it sounds like. There might be the company that's running the scam or whatever they're doing, the advertisement, and they go through one of these smaller calling companies, and that might come through my phone provider and finally get to me. Is that part of what makes it hard to stop these things?
That is one of the hardest parts in this challenge is it's very easy to buy a large block of numbers and use them in an online dialing system to make a large number of calls at the same time. And the challenge is a lot of the infrastructure that's made for legitimate calls can also be abused for illegitimate purposes. And so, you know, one of the things that the carriers are trying to get better about is to really look and analyze their network traffic to see what looks suspicious, and now increasingly with this agreement, confirm the identity of their commercial customers, sort of a know your customer type step that's meant to you know, sort of eliminate bad actors who are sort of turning a blind eye.
As you mentioned, this is a voluntary agreement, even for these big phone companies. Are there any teeth in this deal if they are found to not be doing the things they say they're going to do?
At this point, no, there are not teeth to this one. I will say the call verification effort that I talked about earlier, that the FCC has encouraged carriers to implement. The FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, has said if carriers don't implement it on their own, that he will pass rules that force them to do so. So I think we're approaching a moment where things are likely going to have more teeth. But right now, the approach still is in the category of voluntary. And, you know, there's goodwill to be built with customers. And by the way, state attorneys generals expect you to behave in a certain way. So get on board.
Has there been enforcement against either the companies that create these mass calling efforts for scams or whatever, or against those smaller companies who handle their calling for them?
There have been some enforcement cases brought. I will say that that brings up another challenge in the robocall question. It seems like the challenges are never ending. There are some sort of jurisdictional issues between the FTC and the FCC and what each agency considers in their remit to regulate. And some of the links in the chain that I described fall in one agency's camp and the other falls in the other. And therefore, it makes it difficult to really crack down on each part.
Does this deal, can the people listening say, okay, once this deal kicks in, I'm going to get fewer robocalls? Are we really going to feel this?
Hard to say. It's it's possible. I will say that, you know, having carriers agree to offer call blocking for free is likely beneficial to consumers who maybe had to pay, you know, $5 or more per month for call blocking services in the past. Some of the carriers have said that you can now sort of create a whitelist and block anyone who's not on that. That sort of has its own challenges. And another carrier this week said that you can block all international calls if you think that that's a way to sort of weed out unwanted calls. So there's a lot of different moving pieces that hopefully the end result is sort of stemming the tide. But I think that's a time will tell.
Now, referring anecdotally to one source, that source being me, I remember a time, Sarah, when it seemed like my landline, when I still had that, was flooded with robocalls, and my cell phone, they never found me. That seems to have changed now, and cell phones are easy targets. Is that, can you confirm that's not just a Rob Ferret trend?
That's not just a Rob Ferret trend. And it, you know, it, that brings up an interesting point, which is that there's also robo text messages, which are increasingly popping up, in which the FTC and FCC are getting a growing number of complaints about. So it is, as I said before, a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole where, you know, they sort of, scammers pursue one avenue until people stop responding or they automatically forward their landline to their answering machine. And that sort of becomes a cold sort of channel. And so then they move to your cell phone and that still is a place where they can have success. And now they're switching to text messages. So it really is an ongoing and sort of evolving problem.
As we wrap up, Sarah, you sometimes hear, or I've sometimes heard from people who say, I'm getting a ton of robocalls or in some cases robotexts. Is it worth it for them to report this? And if so, who do they report it to?
It is. It's worth it to report it to the FTC and the FCC. And I will say that sometimes that seems like shouting at an ocean. But the value in that is that they will observe trends and consumer complaints as they decide which cases to pursue and investigate. And so by reporting, you're sort of giving them breadcrumbs or string, for lack of a better analogy, to sort of pull on to try to form the foundation of a case and look for patterns and maybe spot repeat offenders when it comes to either the carriers or the market telemarketing companies or the dialers.
Sarah, thanks for answering our call. We'll try not to abuse the privilege.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Krauss, reporter who covers telecommunications for The Wall Street Journal. She was with us today to talk about an agreement between state attorneys general and major telephone companies to fight illegal robocalls. Coming up, we'll look at what yesterday's Johnson & Johnson ruling means for the 2,000 other opioid-related lawsuits around the country. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Serena Williams' husband, the founder of the website Reddit, wrote a recent op-ed in the New York Times to make a call for better paternity leave in the United States. We'll learn about the state of parental leave in the country and how dads taking time off can affect families and workplaces. Now, an Oklahoma judge has ruled that Johnson & Johnson has to pay $572 million for damages stemming from the state's opioid epidemic. It's the first court ruling against a drug manufacturer in connection with the nationwide problem. According to the Washington Post, more than 400,000 people have died of overdoses from painkillers, heroin, and illegal fentanyl in the last 20 years. Judge Thad Balkman said Johnson & Johnson purposely downplayed the danger of opioids and oversold their benefits.
The opioid crisis has ravaged the state of Oklahoma. it must be abated immediately.
Plaintiffs in other opioid-related lawsuits nationwide cheered the ruling, saying they hope it's a sign of things to come. A Johnson & Johnson attorney has said the company plans to appeal. Lenny Bernstein is a health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post. Lenny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So talk about the significance of this $500 million settlement, though still subject to appeal.
Right. The significance is that this is a landmark. It's the first time that a judge or jury has held a drug manufacturer, a pharmaceutical company, culpable in the epidemic of prescription opioid deaths and addiction. It's the first case of many that will be coming down the pike. But its significance is less in the money, although certainly that's a lot of money, than in the fact that the judge heard 7 weeks of testimony and essentially agreed with the state's argument, basically all of the state's arguments, and disagreed with Johnson & Johnson's.
Now, this is a state of Oklahoma court, so this isn't necessarily precedent for a federal lawsuit or a lawsuit in another state, right?
No, that's a really good point. There are 40-odd states lined up to do the very same thing with different companies, but they have different laws, they have different defendants involved. Some are suing Johnson & Johnson, some are suing other companies. There are all kinds of characteristics of their lawsuits that may not necessarily be true here. That being said, it's not bad and probably encouraging that a judge found Johnson & Johnson culpable when they produce about 1% of the drugs, of the opioids consumed in Oklahoma. So if you're a state and you're thinking of suing someone that, or you have sued someone that produces a lot more, that's pretty good.
And Johnson & Johnson is kind of a unique case. As you say, they don't produce a lot of the drugs themselves, but if I understand this correctly, Lenny, they produce a lot of the raw materials that then another company might use to produce a painkiller.
Yes, at one time they did. They owned these two companies. One was called Tasmanian Alkaloids, and the other one was called Naramco. And between the two of them, they would grow the poppies. They would take the material from the poppies. They would refine it into various what they call active pharmaceutical ingredients. They would bring it over to the United States, and they would sell it to other companies that then converted it into pills and distributed those pills around the state. So in that way, they were involved in about 60% of the opioids that were distributed around the state. The judge said, hey, that's enough. That's culpability right there. He also agreed with the contention that Johnson & Johnson was part of this misinformation deception campaign that the pharmaceutical industry took part in. They organized it, and they basically said to doctors, these things are not as addictive as people tell you, and they're much more effective for minor aches and pains, and it's okay to use them.
And that last part, Lenny, is key to a lot of these lawsuits, right? Not just that, hey, you made and distributed these medications, which do have valid uses, but the case is that Johnson & Johnson and other companies misled, I guess maybe intentionally misled, doctors and patients about the risks and benefits.
Yeah, that's a really critical point. So they would go into doctors. This came out at trial. They would go into doctors, and they would say, look, you know, you guys have been using this for surgical pain, for cancer pain, for end-of-life care, but it's really not as addictive as you think it is. There's a lot of pseudo-addiction. They coined this term pseudo-addiction, and they were telling doctors that these people aren't really addicted. They just want – they're in pain, and so they need more painkiller. And they trained their sales reps on how to downplay the risk and consequences of addiction. And the judge said that was a very key point in his ruling against them.
Talking to Lenny Bernstein from The Washington Post, looking at an opioid lawsuit ruling, this one in the state of Oklahoma, saying Johnson & Johnson has to pay up $500 million. Lenny, how many lawsuits? Just give us a sense of all the lawsuits that are out there right now. This is one among many.
It is. We have two sets of lawsuits. We have 40-odd states lined up to sue in state courts, and they are doing it that way because they have concluded that they have significant advantages in state courts. Then we have over 2,000 cities, counties, Native American tribes, hospital groups, anyone who's basically filed a suit, they've taken all of those and they've consolidated them in this enormous lawsuit in Cleveland before a federal judge. It's called a multi-district litigation. Anybody who filed anywhere around the country, localities and others, Wisconsin and everywhere else, they've put them in this giant group. That's going to start with two counties, Cuyahoga and Summit, Ohio, in October. They're like, they call them the bellwether cases. They're test cases to see how it's going to go.
We see just this afternoon now, Purdue Pharma, makers of OxyContin, a lot of people have painted them as a big bad guy in this case. They say they're offering up to $12 billion to settle a lot of these lawsuits and get out of this big lawsuit. What do we know about that so far?
I'm afraid I just got off an airplane from Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay.
In the last hour. I've read that story. I'm checking into it, but I'm afraid that I don't know whether it's true or not.
But this,
I read what NBC says.
But this could be a trend where a lot of these companies, especially after seeing this lawsuit you were in Oklahoma covering, wanting to maybe settle now and not risk what could come out of these suits.
Definitely. Now, there have been settlement talks all along, and Judge Polster in the MDL up in Ohio has for the past 2 years been encouraging a settlement. He said, listen, neither of you want to go to trial on this. The best thing to do is settle here. So there have been talks off and on all along. But yes, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that Purdue and other drug companies will be incentivized to settle now that they know the first number, the one that Johnson & Johnson has to pay. Some people thought it was going to be a lot larger than that. And so perhaps I guarantee you that today, everybody involved in all of this, both the states and the counties and the cities and the drug companies, they're all weighing their strategies in light of the Johnson & Johnson number.
Right. You mentioned people were looking for a higher number. Prosecutors, I understand, were saying not half a billion, but $17.5 billion spread out to help provide things like drug treatment over a longer period. So they fell well short of what they were looking for.
So we have to be careful with that a little bit. It was $17.5 billion over 30 years. If you divide that up, it doesn't come out to much different than $600 million a year. It's roughly in that ballpark. But what Judge Bachman said was, I can give you a one-year number. I see how much it's going to cost you for 1 year of abating the drug epidemic. What I didn't get sufficient evidence on was years 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and on into the future. So he said, I feel comfortable giving you $572 million for 1 year. After that, I haven't seen sufficient evidence. So the math kind of works out similarly. But yes, in aggregate, they got much less than they asked for.
What cases are you watching for next after this this one shoe dropped in Oklahoma?
Well, the big case is the MDL, the Ohio one that starts in October. Jury selection is October 15th. The two bellwether counties are Cuyahoga and Summit. They have sued some two dozen companies, including Johnson & Johnson. They've sued – one thing that's real interesting about that case is it's not just manufacturers. They've sued distributors, and they've sued the large retail pharmacy chains. So there are a lot more factors involved there. There are hundreds and hundreds of lawyers involved from all different sides. And that's kind of the granddaddy of all of these cases. There are other state cases coming down the road. I can't, off the top of my head, tell you which is the very next one, but all eyes will be turning to Ohio next.
And Lenny, in our last minute or so, do we know if this has changed the way drug manufacturers and distributors are doing business?
I think as a society, we are drastically pulling back on opioids. Yes, I would say that many of these companies, now that they are getting their feet held to the fire, they are starting to change. But what's really happened is that opioid prescribing has gone from 255 million prescriptions in 2012 to 190 million prescriptions in 2017, and it's still going down after that. Everybody has gotten much more careful, from the doctors to the pharmacists to the VA, to the companies themselves. There is definitely a pullback on opioids in America, prescription opioids.
Lenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lenny Bernstein, health and medicine reporter at The Washington Post. We talked about an Oklahoma judge ordering the company Johnson & Johnson to pay $500 million for its role in the state's opioid crisis. State attorneys were asking for $17.5 billion, but as Lenny said, that would be over 30 years. It was the first ruling against a company in more than 2,000 opioid lawsuits across the country. We'll be waiting for the results and the trials in a federal lawsuit, plus state lawsuits in a number of states as well. I'm not a golfer, but given my mini golf experience, I can safely say if I were a golfer, I would be a bad one. But there could be some help for me, a new high-tech golf ball invented by Nissan that can find its own way into the hole. Now, Dean Kinetter is a golfer, Central Time producer. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
So you check this thing out. What do you think?
Well, it's impressive. It looks cool.
Right, because you can see videos of this thing where the ball just kind of curves toward the ball.
They did put out a promo video of it. No question this is cheating. Whether you're okay using it, that's going to be personal preference. For me, I just want a ball that could automatically find the fairway.
And here's the thing, though. I looked a little deeper into it. It's not just a magic ball. You also need to set up a camera, a special camera synced to this ball, and I think a sensor in the hole so the ball can find it. So you can't just go out on the green and do this. You need to do a lot of advance work.
Buying a golf course would help. And set it up for your own family, friends, whoever you want to get out there. It's part of their driverless car technology, but I like this use for it too.
Right, and yeah, my problem would be even getting to the green in the first place, I think, and this ball, if I'm reading this correctly, doesn't help me do that.
That's the struggle. I'm with you there, Rob.
But the amazing thing, Dean, is this is a high-tech thing, and you can whap it around with a golf club, and I guess it still works.
Apparently, it stays intact, and it'll find the hole for you.
All right. Good luck. I know you're going to buy that golf course and put this to the test. That's Dean Kinetter. This is Central Time.